Hey listeners, Greg McKenzie here. We're ready, after a long pause, to put out the remaining episodes of Season 1. But it might help to know this interview was recorded early in 2019, so don't let the timeline discussed confuse you. And with that, enjoy Episode 6 of the Missiology Podcast.
So I'm sitting here with Dr. Scott Sundquist, who is president-elect of Gordon Theological Seminary. And Scott, you'll be starting there in June, is that right?
I'll start July 1st as the president. April 1st, I transition in.
Okay, fantastic. Well, Scott, it's really great, again, to have you here with us, and I really appreciate you giving your time to Missiology Podcast.
Glad to be here.
So before becoming president-elect of Gordon Theological Seminary, you were dean of SIS and the professor of world Christianity since 2012 here at Fuller Theological Seminary.
Correct.
Before that, you were 17 years at Pittsburgh Theological Seminary. Mm-hmm. And then before that, you were in Singapore working as a missionary teaching at a seminary there, the Trinity
Theological College.
Mm-hmm. You worked with InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, mm-hmm. and before that you did your BA at University of North Carolina. Mm-hmm. What was your degree in, by the way?
In history education. So okay. I've been in history ever since I was about 18.
Okay, excellent. And then the MDiv at Gordon Theological Seminary, mm-hmm. and PhD from Princeton Theological Seminary. One of your more recent books is a 2015 Unexpected Christian Century, very much an award-winning text. Mm-hmm. And you're working on some projects right now. Maybe we'll get to hear about those in a little bit.
Good.
So, Scott, let's start out with the first question, mm-hmm. and it has to do with key experiences, specifically high point experiences for you. Tell me about a high point as a practitioner, as a scholar in our field of study in missiology, a time when you have felt particularly motivated and engaged, a time when you felt this experience, you know, is going to shape me. It's shaping my missiology. Yeah. What happened? Who was involved? What did you do?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. As I was thinking over it, my mind just went over like 20 or 30 years, all these different places in the world, and where do I focus? And I think there's two stories I'd like to tell. One is when I was in my PhD program at Princeton. It's a very scholarly, rational approach to studying of history, but my professor was Sam Moffitt, whose father was Samuel Austin Moffitt, the pioneer missionary in Pyongyang, North Korea. And we were reading early Asian Christianity, and some of the stories from the early church, whether it be early Asian or Western church history, there are all these sort of very almost magical, mystical stories of the miraculous. And you wonder, you know, did that really happen that way kind of thing?
Yeah.
And so as we're going through that, as, you know, good rational enlightenment scholars, and we're going through these things, we're kind of, everybody's sort of skeptical that really happened. They're trying to make up these stories, which also has an influence on how we interpret the New Testament, right?
Right.
Some of those stories are pretty strange, you know. And so as we're going through that, Sam said, let me just tell you one story about my father that he would never tell anybody else, but it actually happened and it explains why this whole village became Christian overnight. He was called the walking up the road man because he would never ride on a horse. Later on, he would never ride on a motorcycle. He would always walk.
I love that. What a great name, right?
The walking up the road. I'm looking right into people's faces. If I'm on a horse, I'm looking down at them. If I'm on a motorcycle, I ride too fast.
So I got to walk.
I always have to look at people. Yeah.
That's fantastic.
So the walking up the road man was walking up the road to a village, and he walked up this hill, came to the village, and there was like nobody there.
Yeah.
He saw the houses there and saw some, you know, goats, some dogs running around, some chickens.
So he was actually there to preach the gospel.
He's going
into the village, wanting to do mission work.
A pioneer missionary, and the first time that a Westerner, a Christian, had ever been seen in these areas in North Korea. This is right before he went to Pyongyang, which is another story. So he's walking up, and he looks around, and there's nobody there. And then he walks in, and all of a sudden he sees everybody is in the center of the town. Might be 200-300 people, and there was a stage up front, and the shaman was up there, sitting on a chair with two other men. And so he comes to the back of the crowd, and he taps the man on the shoulder, and he says, what's going on
here? Yeah, what's happening here? Yeah.
And the man says, oh, didn't you hear? Today, a man is going to come from God and tell us how we can know God. And he said, oh, I'm the man. And so he ushered him up front. He went up front, and he told them about Jesus, the cross, and everything. And the shaman listened to him and he says, yes, then we should follow this Jesus.
Wow.
And the whole village converted. Now,
wow.
You can't make something like that up. And some of the evidence is the rapid growth of Christianity in North Korea,
right.
Where Pyongyang became known as the New Jerusalem because it was just so Christian.
Yeah.
So that really turned my thinking about how do I write history without this sort of skeptical enlightenment approach all the time, being open to the work of the Spirit in these miraculous ways. And
that takes God's agency seriously, right?
Yeah.
How do I tell these stories in a way that says God was...
Yeah, but I'm writing for these publishers who want something that's reasonable and sensible. and there are crazy things. I mean, people say stupid things, too. So how do you really weigh? Did that really happen, or how did it happen? And so it created in me a way of writing that guides people towards an openness to thinking about the Spirit working like that. So that even if you're purely secular, you have to say, well, how else could that have happened?
Yeah.
So that was one thing that was very important in the way that I write history and missiology, is to be not duped by any kind of story, but also open to the miraculous work of the Spirit and how things happen.
Amen.
And that continues to come out today. I think another story that really shaped my thinking about the whole field of missiology is when I went overseas and I interacted with people who were church planters in villages in northern Thailand and Myanmar, Pakistan, and so forth. And then I came back, and I was teaching in a mainline seminary in the West, and most of the students were pretty Christian and believed in evangelism. They believed people needed to know the good news of Christ. But most of the faculty were beyond that. You know, they were Enlightenment people who no longer really believed that was important, and they would not emphasize evangelism.
Right.
There was basically a universalism about salvation.
Okay.
So I was teaching an evening class, an evangelism class, and then during the break, somebody across the hall was teaching another course on religions. And so the students got together, and they came over to me and said, Dr. Sundquist, we just found out that evangelism isn't needed anymore. Now all we need is dialogue. Well, what do you mean? Well, because everybody's saved, we all know about it, and so we don't need to do evangelism anymore. And I also thought, wow, that is so interesting. You know, how we get so it shaped everything that I do. When I write for a broader audience, or I write for a more evangelical audience or Catholic, I always keep that gospel in the center and the need for everybody to look Jesus in the face and say yes.
Yeah.
Or be given the opportunity to say yes. And so coming from overseas where everybody was an evangelist, 93% of my students in Singapore were converts.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're a convert, you remember what it was like before and after, and you want other people to know.
That's right.
And so I didn't have to convince my students there. They were up every morning at, you know, 5:30 or 6, up on the rooftop, walking around, praying, reading their Bibles and everything. I would look out from my apartment. I'd see them. This is amazing.
Yeah.
Every morning, all these students out there praying because they're just so thankful to be able to read God's Word and to talk to God.
Yeah.
And they want their family members to know.
Yeah.
So, you know, those are kind of...
They haven't even been given a paradigm of a Christian that's not a missionary, right? I mean, there's no such thing as a Christian that's not a disciple maker.
That's right.
They haven't even seen that.
Yeah,
it's not
because
been modeled
if you're a convert,
them.
You just can't imagine not telling other people.
That's right.
Because of the way it changed your life.
That's right. I had the pleasure of being in a context like that and working in a context like that in China, in Hubei province.
Mm-hmm.
And it was fantastic while I was working there. One of the fun stories was a young lady named, she chose an English name, Lola.
Mm-hmm.
And she was very quiet and always sat very quietly, kind of taking notes mm-hmm. when we were going through the Gospel of Luke. And by the end of the Gospel, she said, we're studying through the Gospel, and it was about 2 months. By the end, she said, I want to be baptized. And we're like, that's fantastic. That's really exciting. We're going to do it on Saturday. You know, show up. And, mm-hmm. and so she shows up with 4 other people. And they all want to be baptized.
Yeah.
And we're like, wait, who are these people?
Yeah,
We've never met them. We've never
yeah.
seen them before.
Yeah.
And turns out that Lola had been taking notes because she was going back to her dorm room.
Telling all of her friends.
Exactly. That's and right. they were all sitting there in like rapt attention, like, tell us about what you learned today. And so here, quiet little Lola was an evangelist before she was even
now,
a Christian.
Now, what you've just told is a great sort of icon of the way the world is evangelized.
Yeah.
A missionary is cross-cultural. So she's like this cross-cultural person learning from you.
Right.
But most of the conversions, most of the growth of the church takes place by indigenous people.
That's right.
And so we don't know all of their names. The missionaries are often famous, but most of the conversion, and also for the pastor. A pastor may be training his congregation to be evangelists, but most of the people come to faith or don't come to faith by the pastor.
Right.
It's by the indigenous people working in the marketplace.
Praise
That's
God.
A great story.
So If other stories come to mind for you of high points that have been significant in shaping you, we can revisit this question. But my second question is about how you've been influenced by other missiologists, right? Other people thinking about theology and mission, other practitioners, other missionaries. So maybe name one or two primary books or even conversations that have contributed to your research and ministry. Maybe what was the content of those conversations and why did they make a difference for you?
Yeah. Let me be a name dropper here, if you'll excuse me. It's not that I know all these famous people because I'm famous, but it's just because I'm old. And when you're older, you know more people, you know. So, but the people that really influenced me, both personally and in the writings, were Sam Moffitt, my advisor, and David Bosch, who we brought him to Princeton to interview for a position. So I spent about 3 or 4 days with him, taking him around and talking.
What a gift.
Andrew Walls, who we also interviewed at Princeton and tried to get him to come there. And so again, I had about 3 days and got to know him there and then invited him to teach with me in Singapore at one time. And there are others, but I think those would be three primary. Probably Ogbu Kalu for the work in Africa and his awareness of what happened in the African revivals, because he was writing from his own personal experience. That was his life. And so when he was writing about what was going on, not only in West Africa, but also in East Africa, he was writing his own history. And when he would get up and give a lecture, it was so boring. But as soon as he started talking about those revivals, you know, everybody would be converted. It was just overwhelming. And so these would be some of the people, I think, that had the most influence. But let me tell you a little bit about the impact of David Bosch. His book, Transforming Mission, was huge for me, because what he was doing is he was freeing up the study of missiology from sort of a single paradigm to see how it's changed through history. And I'm a historian, and it really is a historical work. Yeah. He's looking at these different interpretations through history. And later on, I realized that what he did was he was really bridging the gap between the modern and the postmodern. In some ways, it's still a very modern work. His refusal to really engage with the Old Testament, because there's no real, you know, Christian mission in the Old Testament, rather than being opened up, as others are, to seeing God's continuing missionary activity as a missionary God and being able to interpret that. Plus, his paradigms are very modern in the way they are written up. And I find that helpful. That's sort of the way I was raised and trained. But as I have grown and developed and done more and more writing, I realized that where he was headed, he still ends up with these paradigms that are a little bit too tight and modern.
Okay. Yeah.
And so anyway, he was very influential for me. And I think another way that he was influential is his personal story, his biography. His son Jacques has a severe eye handicap, and they stayed in. We had him over for dinner a couple of times in our apartment in Princeton, and Jacques would sit right there in front of the TV, and I could just see the sensitivity of this man living under apartheid at that time, and having a son who had this severe disability, and helping him and being attentive to him, and then also seeing the way that he and his wife worked closely together. And later on, when he passed, I had 2 or 3 hours with his wife to talk and debrief about times that we'd had together in the past. And I could see that his missiology and his life came out of his family, his relationships, his experience in South African apartheid, and his deep love for his good friends in the faith who were being oppressed by that social order, which was really a social disorder. I think Andrew Walls, one of the statements that was overwhelming for me was when he talked about working in Ghana and having finished his patristic studies and getting ready to teach there. He had the hardest time the first year until he realized he wasn't talking so much to 20th century Christians, but to Christians who were like second century Christians, as Christians. They were 20th century people, but they were living just, you know, a couple generations away from conversion. And so they're still developing their Trinitarian theology. They're still developing their Christology in their context. And for him to say that was just amazing, brilliant thing to do, to understand that the early church, the ancient church, better describes the experience of modern people coming to faith than the modern world. And then to understand how the nature of Christianity is being both, you know, incarnational and pilgrim. That principle has driven me in everything that I do, everything that I teach, and I think it's exactly right. It needs to be nuanced a little bit, I think, because other religions have, I mean, Islam is not totally non-incarnational. It does have incarnational elements, but Christianity from its very beginning of having, you know, God actually come into flesh, that was the biggest hurdle in the early church, and that continues to be the major characteristic or DNA element of the faith.
Yeah.
So those, I would think, would be some major elements that have shaped my writing and my thinking.
You know, one of the questions that I'm just curious about, so you had a chance to meet and talk to David Bosch, and his text and his work, his articles, especially Transforming Mission, have been, they were an important moment in our field of study.
Oh, yeah.
And you're the only person I've met that actually has talked to him or, you know, had an opportunity to engage him over a number of days.
Before you ask a question, let me interrupt you.
Yeah, go for it. Yeah, please.
One of my biggest impressions of David Bosch is he was being called, interviewed to come to Princeton in the midst of apartheid beginning to be dismantled in the late 80s. And how was he going to make this decision?
Yeah.
Because he was good friends of Bishop Tutu and a number of other people. And the Kairos document, he was right there in the editing of that document. And so how was he going to make this decision? And so I, being kind of weak and young and not very Christian, said, oh, you can have a greater influence if you come to the United States, because then you can speak to the American church and put pressure on the South African government, you know. And he says, well, I have to submit to my friends in South Africa. And so when he went back, he went and talked about it and said, you know, would it be better if I went there and put pressure on the U.S. government and the church in the United States to speak up, because the South African government did have to respond to economic pressures and so forth. And but in making that decision, before he went back, I took him back to his room. He says, why don't you come on in and we'll pray. And so we came in his room, and here's this man, what was he, 6'7 or 6'6? It was big, long, big South African farmer hands, you know.
Yeah.
Got down and clasped his hands together, got down on his knees, and we just prayed. He just poured his heart out, praying that God's will be done and that he would know what God's will was. Not that he was going to say, oh, I really want to do this, God, you know, you know, what is your will? You know, how can we? And I saw him interceding for the blacks of South Africa in Princeton, New Jersey. And that was overwhelming. And what I saw there is his missiology comes out of love. And I'm going to connect all of my history here together right now. One of my favorite sermons ever delivered was Jonathan Edwards' sermon, Heaven is a World of Love. And he describes, you know, from the simple phrase, you know, God is love from 1 John, he unpacks what does that mean then? Because in heaven, all of the sin is gone, and so it's pure love. And so I think as we're shaped more and more into the likeness of Christ, the love of Christ, the grace of Christ, the forgiveness of Christ begins to pour out, and also the service and the self-sacrifice of Christ pours out into our lives. And that's what I saw in Bosch. And so remember, he died going to do a funeral in a black township. And that's why he died, because when the accident, the police wouldn't go there, the ambulance wouldn't go there. That's a black township, just let it go, we don't care about that.
Yeah.
And so he laid down his life for his friends.
Wow.
So, boy, to have a missiology come out of a life like that, that's special.
It is really special. Yeah. I think it's indicative of how influential he's been, right? I mean, the Holy Spirit saying, this is a man that I've anointed. This is someone who understood love.
Yeah.
You know, this is a work that needs to be read and reread and perhaps even shape. And I think you're right. For me, there are aspects of his pluriverse that still continue to be very modernist in orientation. But in many ways, for us as a field of study, he's been a bridge into late modern conversations.
You know,
we needed that. We needed someone who wasn't just going to drop us in the deep end.
Right.
That was going to help lead us into.
Yeah, the way that I look at it is, he was standing at the precipice looking ahead to missiology in the 21st century, and he highlighted the different cities that he saw on the horizon.
Right.
So here's the city of church unity. Here's the city of faith and order. Here's the city of contextualization. You know, and so he saw those different areas, but he didn't know yet how that was all going to come together. So that prevented me from writing anything about missiology, because I was just so overwhelmed by the book. And after I taught it, that book, about 10 or 12 years, I finally felt
was like, this in Pittsburgh? Where was it that you taught
Pittsburgh.
Bosch originally?
Yeah, I taught it in Pittsburgh. I taught history when I was in Asia, and then I taught missiology and history in Pittsburgh. And it was after about 10 years, I felt like, I think now there are other things that need to be said.
Mm-hmm.
You know, his interpretation of the New Testament was very, you know, sort of higher criticism, mm-hmm. you know, New Testament Enlightenment approach.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there are other ways of doing that. And for me, it was patristics.
Mm-hmm.
It was seeing the early church as a lens for how we need to view missiology.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I began writing, I began to say, okay, now he kind of unraveled what happened in the past and began to show the different threads.
Mm-hmm.
My responsibility in my missiology is now, okay, I'm going to make a fabric from those threads that's a missiology for basically North Americans in the 21st century.
Mm-hmm.
So what I try to do is tell that history and then pull it together and make some statements.
Mm-hmm.
And so the three parts of that book really relate to putting back together some of the threads that Bosch identified.
Mm-hmm.
And I never could have written that book had Bosch not done what he had done.
Excellent.
Yeah.
I'm curious, as you think about, you gave us this fantastic picture of Bosch, and I love it. His hands clasped together, praying for God's will to be done, motivated by love.
Yeah.
As you think about your relationship, for instance, to and your relationship to Andrew Walls, what are the pictures that come to mind when you think of, again, another key figure when it comes to understanding our field of study?
Yeah, I think that for my image of Andrew Walls, he's so understated. Oh my gosh, so humble, so understated. Is he says, well, Scott, you know, kind of pauses for a moment, and then all of a sudden this brilliant statement comes out that shapes something, and he just thought of it. And he didn't have time to write it. He didn't have time to write a book, so he just gave talks, and then...
Yeah.
Bill Burroughs and other people from Orbis put them together as books to make a statement.
Yeah.
But it's just he's too committed to helping PhD students and helping other people doing editing and writing and doing a talk. And I remember seeing him do a talk in East Tennessee at, I think, Emanuel School of Religion there. Mm-hmm. And he had his notes there, and he just sort of like he just had typed it up and added some things at the end, and it's went right in exactly like 55 minutes it was supposed to be, and he kind of ended. And then he had to move on. He was doing another original talk, not using the same material, but another original talk somewhere else, and he wouldn't have time to go back and finish that editing. So his commitment to, and I saw that many times at American Society of Missiology meetings.
Wow.
He would be over there sitting in a dark corner editing somebody's PhD chapter.
Wow.
Because he was so committed to helping other people.
Yeah. It's wonderful when your legacy to a field of study is a host of brilliant minds.
Yeah, yeah.
Your legacy is the people that you've mentored. And for Andrew Walls, that's certainly the case, right?
Yeah,
there are so many names that say, thank you, Andrew.
Yeah. Oh, the number of people.
Yeah.
We have publishers, editors, scholars, students, a lot of Africans.
Yeah.
And his commitment to Africa that just never ended.
Yeah.
Never ends. It's just great.
That's awesome. So my third question,
mm-hmm.
Scott, is explicitly about God's agency in your life. Can you describe a time that you recognized, that you were aware that God was shaping you? Or maybe it's just looking back on it and you realize God was shaping me. That was God showing up and shaping me as a missiologist.
Yeah.
Tell me how this happened.
Yeah, at first it was just through the mind. I was a mediocre college student, and then I worked for InterVarsity, and you know, every week I was doing evangelism and meeting with people and Karen's conversations, so I was developing my own apologetics. So by the time I went to seminary, I was so eager to learn. I had so many questions.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to take everything I could in history and Bible. Because
mm-hmm.
in my mind, the things that I needed to know were, how did we get to this point today? Why do we believe this,
mm-hmm.
first of all? And then secondly, I want to go and see what the Bible actually says. You know,
yeah.
Every young MDiv student wants the same thing.
That's right.
So at first, I think the shaping was serious biblical study, grammar, diagramming sentence in the New Testament and so forth, and that was very formative for me to take the Bible seriously and to realize that there is a very important service to the church, a missiological service of the mind, and it's not just doing, because so much mission is just doing, and we all know what to do, so let's go out and do it, but to take the time to really think and to use the mind in service and mission. But then I think the biggest part where I saw God shaping me as a missiologist was teaching church history and Asian church history in Asia. So I was teaching Asian church history. What, the audacity of this white guy from, you know, Philadelphia.
Going to Singapore
and telling these Asians about their history. But they didn't know it. And frankly, they didn't care about it because they were more interested in studying the Western church history. And so this was a part of my conversion. Why is it they wanted to study Western church history?
Right.
Part of it is this sort of colonialism, that, you know, wanting to go back to the colonial empires and seeing that as superior in some way. But part of it also is just publications and literature.
Yep.
I would be teaching Western church history, and the students loved it. They want to learn about John Wesley, all these books about John Wesley, John Wesley's works and everything.
Yeah.
Luther talks, they can learn about Martin Luther. They want to know about John Calvin and everything. And then I would get to Asian church history.
Yeah.
And I talk about somebody who actually preached in Singapore, John Sung. And they should all care a lot about it. Well, some of them knew stories from their parents, but they were not motivated. I said, why aren't you motivated?
Yeah, yeah.
This is your history. This is Asia. You're in Asia.
What'd they say? How'd they respond?
And they said, well, there are all these resources for the West, the Oxford Dictionary, the Christian Church. You can look these things up.
Yeah.
But there's nothing for us. So when I want to look up something, you mention something in class, and then you have to find an article or something. There's no one
place
to go.
There's nothing to direct them to. There's nothing you can say, hey, read up on it more if you're interested.
That's right.
Here and there.
Yep, yeah, there's nothing. And so it came out of that I said there needs to be a reference book for Asians.
Yeah.
And so at the ripe old age of 33, I came up with the idea of doing a dictionary of Asian Christianity.
Yeah.
And I didn't have a clue, you know, what that meant because I'd never written an article or anything in my life. I just came to be a missionary.
Yeah.
I didn't plan on publishing anything. And so this really created a conversion because the next 11 years of my life were taken up in traveling to about 14 different countries in Asia, gathering together historians from every representation of the church. So we had Nazarenes, we had Adventists, we had Catholics, we had Catholics from different religious orders, we had Presbyterians, whoever was there, Pentecostals. And we would gather them together for 3 or 4 days and go over what terms needed to be in this important reference book for their country. And so we did that for every country and for some islands, like there'd be Java, there'd be Sulawesi, and so we would take a look geographically like that. And then I said, you know, for the Catholics, a lot of the ways he divided up is the religious orders, because the area was not so much evangelized or missionized by country, but a religious order would have these two or three countries. And so you see the Jesuits here, you see the Dominicans here, but not here. And so then we had to do entries on that. And so articles were turned in the next 6 or 8 years in about 8 or 10 languages. Most of them I had to have somebody else translate them for me.
Yeah.
And then the translations had to be checked and written.
Yeah.
So it was a very labor-intensive work over 11 years.
Tremendous act of love as well. I mean, this is an act of love in the sense that you're thinking about your students and going, you have a fantastically rich heritage and you need access to it.
Yeah.
Let me... You know, and that's fantastic, noticing God's agency and God directing you to, look, there's this need here.
Well, and for some reason or another, I was smart enough, probably from my training under Sam Moffitt, to allow all of the stories to be told by local people. Okay. So we had a few missionaries, maybe 10% were missionaries who worked there for at least 10 or 20 years, so they really you know, knew the area. But most all the articles are written by this brilliant young group of Asian church historians, which really began to develop, I would say, in the 80s, mostly in the 90s. So they were just coming up. Thomas van den Ent from the Netherlands was training a whole cadre of Indonesian church historians. He was amazingly focused on that. So when I went to Indonesia, about half of the historians were his...
Right from his
cohort. Right from his group, and he pulled that group together for me. So I was able to go in most any country in Asia and call a church historian, you know, or have some of them help me with it. And one of the things I learned there is how you have to write history and missiology understanding how people think culturally, contextually. For example, in Korea, I couldn't get a whole different group of Koreans come together. They don't come together. So if I had a major Presbyterian historian, he wouldn't know any Catholics. And he even wasn't sure the Catholics are Christians.
Right.
And then if I got another from another Presbyterian group, he wouldn't invite this other Presbyterian group because they don't talk to each other. And so I actually had to do most of that work individually by writing those people from outside of Korea, because there was not a real trust in ecumenical. I did have one ecumenical group to bring them together. Yeah. But then in India, they would all come together and they loved to talk. And I would be up at the chalkboard writing down the terms. Somebody would mention something, somebody else would argue about it, and somebody would go on. And I didn't know what to do. And so finally, one of the people said, "Why aren't you writing down all the terms?" I said, "What do you mean?" "Well, you've only written down one word." I said, "Well, have we agreed on another?" "We've agreed on six of them." I said, "Well, what are they?" So they said, "Let me get up there." So an Indian had to get up there because they understood the conversation. Yeah. And when they had talked enough about one and moved on to another, they had decided.
Yeah.
And I didn't know how they had decided. So the discourse, the discussion was very, very cultural. So that was a real important element for me, thinking about how do you teach in different places? How do you do scholarship in different places that will honor it and help to lift up the best of scholarship in that country?
Amen.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. So this leads into the next question, mm-hmm. because my next question is about your contributions. In your writing, in your presentation, what do you think, what do you see as perhaps the most valuable ways that you contribute to our field of study in theory, in practice? Tell me about experiences also that kind of give rise to these conceptual developments for you. So I'm looking for valuable ways that you contribute.
Yeah. Again, I can't take much credit for this, but I think later on I identified what I had done. Sometimes that's the way it is with scholarship. You do something and you say, "Oh, I did that." Yeah. And, "Oh, doesn't everybody do that?" "Oh, I guess that's no." So with a dictionary, there's no way a single person could write it, not even for one country, mm-hmm. because it's so diverse. If you're writing, let's say, Christian history or mission history in Thailand, well, some people know the tribal peoples up north. Some people know the work among Muslims in the south. Some people know. And so it's just very diverse. And so you really need a cooperative team effort. So the idea of collaboration in missiology and global church history is just a part of my blood. Mm. So everything that I do is collaborative.
Yeah.
I have a new book proposal here, or a contract that I'm going to sign on writing a church history book, and I've written into that a collaborative book, on an introductory volume on church history. The dictionary involved about 490 people.
Wow.
So that's very collaborative.
That's impressive, yeah.
But it was very complex and very hard to do. But the voice of people in Jakarta, you know, comes mm-hmm. out. The voice of the Chinese, kind of restrained, telling their history right when after the fall of the bamboo curtain, because they're doing the scholarship right after 89, 90.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're very restrained scholarship. It would be written very differently today.
Right.
But so it comes out that way.
Yeah.
And then when I did the History of the World Christian Movement with Dale Irvin, we just naturally pulled together people from all over the world as readers and consultants. And so we had, I think, about six meetings, anywhere from 20 to 35 people from all over the world. We had one or two Brazilians, maybe from Colombia, from South Korea, from India, from Switzerland, and representing Catholic churches, Pentecostal churches, Presbyterian, Methodist, the whole gamut, so that if a Pentecostal from South India picks up this book, it makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, they see themselves in there,
yeah.
and they would understand it.
Yeah.
But also, if a Roman Catholic from Brazil would pick it up, they'd say, "Yeah, okay, I see myself in there, and that helps me understand these others."
Yeah.
So if somebody from Ghana, a Presbyterian from Ghana, is picking up the book, they should be able to understand what's written there. So by having a collaborative work where other people are reading, quite often people say, "Why did you say that? I don't understand that." "Oh, we assume too much." So for the reader coming from China, we're going to have to build a bridge of understanding from what they know to what we're going to teach them about. So that whole idea of collaboration and scholarship has been very much a part of my blood when it comes to that kind of writing. I think a second thing that became true, and I'll explain why, is that spirituality is more important to God's mission than proper strategy. And what I mean by that is the great work that takes place in the world is usually not because people really planned well and everything. God is constantly surprising us.
Mm.
But he surprises us through our intimate relationship with him. just like that story about Samuel Austin Moffat mm-hmm. going up to that village. Well, his strategy was basically just go from village to village and preach the gospel. It's kind of a basic sort of Jesus and the 12 kind of thing. It wasn't much other than that, but his spirituality was very deep spirituality. Mm-hmm. He was attentive to God's leading.
What did that look like in his life?
In Sam Moffat's life?
Yeah, what did it look like, his spirituality? I mean, in what ways were the practices that were significant?
Yeah, I don't know him a lot, except that he was just immersed in Scripture and in prayer, and it comes through again and again in his letters. He was alone a lot. I mean, he was traveling, walking up the road. He might have one person with him. Okay. So he had a very deep, intimate relationship with Christ.
Mm, that's excellent.
So when I wrote my missiology book, Understanding Christian Mission, even though I do the history stuff, I do mm-hmm. the theology stuff, I end up with spirituality. And the reason that I ended up with spirituality is as I was teaching mission for 17 years, in Pittsburgh, I realized almost every time, halfway through the course, I'd have two different responses from students. One response was, do we have to read all that chapter? And I would think, yeah, you have to read all that chapter. Well, you know, this doesn't really seem to be very important for me. I mean, you know, I'm going to be, you know, working in a church in Western Pennsylvania. Why do I have to know this stuff? Mm. You know, and the other response would be, and this literally happened, Dr. Sunkus, my wife and I would like to take you out to dinner because we think that God's calling us to North Africa to work with Muslims. Mm-hmm. I said, really? Why is that? Well, you know, you have us pray for countries of the world, and as we've been praying for these countries of the world, and this particular couple I'm thinking of now, they're still there, 12 years later.
Wow.
So how can it be that I'm teaching the same class, the same students, and some people say, do I have to read this? And the others say, I'm going to lay down my life for Muslims.
Wow. Wow.
And I think what it is in the class, I would require students, I don't know if you could require this, but 5 days a week, Monday through Friday, you had to use the Operation World Book and pray for a country.
That's fantastic.
So you'd open the book and you'd pray and you'd learn about countries. And then another question, this seems kind of elementary.
I love it.
I forgot I did this, but I would require students to be able to identify every country in the world.
I love it.
So I'd have these blank maps, and I'd say A, B, C, D, what country is this? So they would actually know where Chad is and Malawi and so forth. Because if all the world is on God's heart, we ought to at least know where these places are. Mm. And if we have the opportunity and ability to learn all these things, we should not renege on that responsibility to lift up the nations of the world. Yes. And so I think that the major work that we do in mission is really a very much a spiritual work. And the impact that we have on people more than anything else is that that deep work of God's Spirit in people's lives.
Scott, I really appreciate the way that this is reflected in your own life. I feel it's one thing to say that spirituality matters. I think you model it in a way that's very powerful, certainly for us as PhD students and your colleagues as well. Thank you for modeling that.
Well, let me drill back on it. The reason I'm different today than I was 20 years ago, as we all are, but in some ways God grabbed a hold of me when I had a student who had a real failure in their spirituality. Mm-hmm. And I was challenged to really, I don't want to say lift my game. But another thing is, my son-in-law was reading the Philokalia, the early writings of the church fathers. And I began that, and I just read the introduction again and realized that the early church fathers understood that the responsibility of theology, there's no such thing as, you know, systematic theology, dogmatic theology. For them, it was all spiritual theology. All theology was to come to live your life deeper into God. Mm. And so for living our life deeper into God, that means more and more our life, our expression becomes that of being the presence of Christ for people. Mm. And if we are being the presence of Christ for people, Christ is the missionary of God, then naturally our life is going to be the missionary of God
That's
wherever
right.
we go.
That's right.
So it's come a lot through reading the early church, and my dissertation was on patristics in Asia, so that's another common theme that I will always hold on to, I think.
That's excellent. So one of my questions, follow-up question on this collaborative spirit and these practices of collaboration in the midst of scholarship is very significant, and I do think that's part of the moment right now for missiology, right? That recognition that this needs to be a dialogical process for you and I as we develop these these concepts, these missiologies. Mm-hmm. So one of my questions then is, how did you do that? Well, tell me about maybe some just kind of core practices, mm-hmm. or maybe one or two kind of things when you get people sitting down in a room. Yeah. Well, even that in and of itself is a kind of a core practice, right? Yeah. So getting diverse peoples in a room. But I'm curious, off the top of your head, those of us who are getting started early in the career, and we're thinking about, we know collaboration needs to be a part of our future scholarship. Mm. How do we do it?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think the surprise to me was I was a nobody out there in Singapore. Nobody knew. I hadn't published anything. And I sent out, at that time, faxes and letters, aerograms, before the internet was, you know, very hot. And people would agree to meet with me. They would agree to come. And all I was doing was paying their transportation.
Okay.
I wasn't paying them money to come together. And what it was is they all shared a common concern to tell their story about their church. They were all people who cared deeply about the subject. They cared about the history of Christianity. And most of them loved these pioneer missionaries who brought the gospel to them. So that put a lie to the myth that comes from the West that missionaries were always oppressive and like them and so forth. No, they loved these key people who came and told them about Jesus Christ. So I was shocked that people, I was shocked at first, and then I realized, oh, well, of course. They're talking about something dear to them, and they want to come and do that, and they want to contribute. So if it comes to missiology or mission history or mission theology or whatever it might be, and you find people that really care about that, they want to come together and talk about it. And it doesn't cost a lot except to get them together.
Got it.
And then when you get together, what do? Well, I didn't come and say, well, let's talk about this. I always took the initiative and had maybe 15 or 20-page outline of the next six chapters of the book. Mm-hmm. Very detailed. I'd done a lot of work.
Okay.
So from my perspective, drawing on indigenous, like let's say I'm doing Africa in the 18th century. So I would look for anything that some of my people, like Philomena and Kalu and others, had written. Mm-hmm. So I have African historians that I read their stuff, and I put that in there. And then I might, at that time, call Kalu and say, Kalu, what do you think about this? Oh, I have this article, and he would send it to me.
Okay.
So I had done my work. I tried to let them speak from their perspective in my outline, and I put it out there, and it was like having Dale Irvin said it was like about six or eight PhD dissertation defenses, because you have all these people that know a lot more about what you're writing about than you do, and they're questioning you on it, and you defend it. And often people from maybe China or Singapore were sympathetic because they felt badly for me. They said, well, I didn't know that either. You know, how's that? And so you have to have a high level of trust, and you have to have people that aren't possessive of stuff but are freely will give.
Yeah.
And they say, you don't have to give credit for me. You know, just the, you know, this is your word kind of thing. So they were very gracious about that. And they would come up. Some people would write a two- or three-page outline of a section that I could use. Said, here, just use this. Well, should I give you credit? No, it's all right. Just put in your own words. So it was amazing how much they cared about telling the story well, and they would collaborate. And there was once or twice we had to kick somebody off the boat because they didn't get along with somebody else, so they were disinvited to the next party. Mm-hmm. But you have to have that kind of discipline. Mm-hmm. So I would say people who have a mutual interest will come. Mm-hmm. Two, you have to come prepared and actually write something. Three, you have to allow the discussion, the discourse. Mm-hmm. Four, you have to take really good notes. In that meeting, we'd take like a verbatim notes and go back and look at it again and then make those changes. And then five, you're going to have to write it and knowing that everybody's not going to agree. And you're going to have to make a commitment and know what the benefits are of choosing this and what are the liabilities, because you can't tell everything.
Okay. Thank you. That's very helpful. Yeah. I appreciate that. And I appreciate also that you, regard to the spirituality and that you gave us some practices there too. I appreciate that. One of your statements was, God surprises us.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
God surprises us.
Yeah.
My last question is about hopes.
Mm-hmm.
If you had two or three wishes about shaping missiology or the shape of missiology over the next decade or two, what are your hopes for the changing shape of our field of study?
Yeah, I have about six or eight. I'll try to narrow it
Go
down.
For it. Go for it.
The first one is that when I did my first draft of Understanding Christian Mission, the editor, a wonderful man, said, I don't know, I've got to read it again. I said, is it too long? Well, I don't know. It was too long. And, but the history section is too long. Well, it is kind of long. The history section is kind of long. But let me read it again. He said, and then he read it again. He came back to me and he says, I think I figured out what it is. This is not a typical introduction to mission book. This is describing Christian existence as a missional existence. Mm-hmm. And I said, thank you.
Amen.
Because that is the way I think. I don't think about mission as a separate category. I think of our existence as a Christian, as I described before, growing into Christ,
yes,
living in the Trinity, is our life in the Trinity is a missional life.
Yes.
Constantly going out in proclamation and declaration, coming back in praise, going out in proclamation, coming back in praise. So that kind of movement always needs to be there. So I thank my editor, James Ernest, for being able to identify that. Mm-hmm. And I would like missiology to be like that, to see both the special calling of some people to sell all they have, go give to the poor, and, mm-hmm, and come and follow Christ into different cultures, but also the people that are staying here to see their existence as a missional existence and,
yep,
have that so overlapped that they could, at the age of 55 or 60, now, using the skills that I have as an engineer, I'm going to go help do some of this water purification work in Nigeria.
Yeah.
And so you always are living in this tenuous existence of ready to go. You know, your bags are always packed.
That's right.
So that's living in a missional existence. And I'd like that to be more dominant.
One of the things that I love about that is the way that your life reflects that.
Mm-hmm.
So you are now president-elect of Gordon Theological Seminary, mm-hmm, and your area of expertise,
mm-hmm,
you are a missiologist.
Right.
And so that they are calling you to Gordon Theological, mm-hmm, knowing that you're bringing this perspective, right? Knowing that you are bringing this into every aspect of theology and,
yeah,
the training of
yeah,
God's people.
And I intentionally chose on my business card president and professor of missiology. I could have said president and professor of world Christianity, but Gordon Conwell will be known now as a seminary that in what we do, we're thinking missionally. And so I think that to be consistent with who I am and who they hired,
yeah,
they were,
yeah,
looking for somebody who would engage in the world. I said, well, that's the way I'm going to be thinking. And, I'm already thinking that way. But let me go a little bit further with this missional existence. I have a book coming out July 1st as a little plug.
Mm-hmm.
And it came out of that book on Understanding Christian Mission.
Okay.
Where I talked about I have a yin-yang diagram of church as always being involved in worship and witness. The two basic purposes, the only two purposes of the church are worship and witness, or worship and mission, or however you want to, mm-hmm, the gathering and the scattering, mm-hmm, is the way we always function. So in one way, we do that every week.
Yeah.
We gather together and worship, and it might be two or three times with a small group and prayer group or something. And then we scatter. When we scatter, we're going out into the world and representing Christ in those places so that people see something of God's love wherever we go, mm-hmm, hopefully.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this book is called Why Church? And basically, mm-hmm, what I'm trying to do is, within that context of those two basic purposes, describe for either younger people or new Christians, why is the church so significant and important? Mm-hmm. Because I think there is a de-emphasization of the importance of ecclesiology in the, mm-hmm, church today.
Mm-hmm.
And so it comes out of visiting lots of churches in the L.A. area when we first came to California, and realizing that so many of them were making up church as they went along.
Mm-hmm.
And so I deal with this concept of connection with Jesus and connection with the early church, connection with the Bible, and context. So it's always connection, mm-hmm, and context, connection and context. And so we want to look back and make sure that we're connected to the great tradition of the church,
mm-hmm,
and that we're not doing something that the early church would say, oh my gosh, that's not at all what Jesus meant. Why are you doing that? And so we want to make sure that
There's that connection.
Yeah, that connection. And it might be something like using some of those same ancient prayers,
mm-hmm,
to continue to participate with the life of Christ that the early church had. It might be a simple thing like that.
Mm-hmm.
But it certainly has to do with certain rhythms of worship.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be another thing that I hope for is, as we teach about ecclesiology in the church. We have this sort of missional understanding that everything we do is for this, I guess, like a two-stroke engine, mm-hmm. you know, kind of thing.
Yeah. That's excellent. Can you tell me more about the context?
Yeah, and this is where the context has to be rooted in the connection. So much of our study today, we love context today, mm-hmm. especially in North America. We love to be relevant. But a lot of relevance is irrelevant to the kingdom. Mm-hmm. So we don't want to just be cool and have people say, oh, that's really neat that you meet in a coffee shop or you meet in a pub. And I have actually had somebody who wanted to plant a church by setting up a brewery. And I said, you're in this urban area where there's a problem with alcoholism and drug addiction, and you want to start a brewery. But it just wanted to be, you know, relevant to their group.
Yeah.
And so being relevant is not the same as being contextual.
Yeah.
Being contextual means that when I talk about Jesus and his love, it's understood. Mm-hmm. It connects to the heart. And so it's not just academic, scholastic. It's also emotional, and it's also very relational. And so we have to think about how does our worship really connect with the hearts of people. So I would argue that a lot of our development of worship songs and worship is important. I think that's mm-hmm. that is significant. I would not decry even the songs that talk a lot about me, 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 because the Psalms also talk about me and God. David was very concerned about himself as an individual as well as the nation. Yeah. And so it is, I think, quite appropriate to mm-hmm. develop. So worship songs can be that way, but also other ways that we connect and meet and where we meet, mm-hmm. All of these things, and the language that we use. Mm-hmm. When we have immigrant churches and a number of different ethnic groups, we need to be attentive to that mm-hmm. and find ways of connecting contextually with these different ethnic groups in a church of this great diversity. And if there's not, then let's say I have a friend who's planting a church in the Rust Belt in western Pennsylvania, in Oil City. Mm-hmm. And that's a place that really peaked like the beginning of the 20th century. Yeah, it's been downhill ever since.
Yeah.
And so what does it mean to plant a church there? Well, what it means is to understand the people's lives. Mm-hmm. What are the needs? Where does Christ need to be very present for them? Mm-hmm. And there's lots of problems of depression and addiction, unemployment or underemployment. And so the church needs to be relevant in those ways mm-hmm. and connecting there. So that would be some of the contextual kinds of questions that we would ask.
Excellent. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. So tell me about some other hopes that you have.
Yeah. This one I'm going to say briefly because I might get in trouble. And that is, as I travel around the world and I see a lot of missiology that's developed, there is a Christian Zionism that is a false hope, I think, for the future in mission, and it troubles me because a lot of money is spent, a lot of teaching is spent that really misleads people away from caring for the basic needs of people that are poor and that are hungry and without the gospel, mm-hmm. and a great emphasis on going to Israel, praying for the rebuilding of the temple, and I think those are all false hopes. That did not become significant at all in church history until the 19th century. And as a matter of fact, Israel, as a state, the Jews had to be convinced of this by both Christian Zionists and a very few Jewish Zionists in Europe. Yeah. But most Jews did not want to return to Israel. Mm-hmm. They were settled in Europe and had lives. And it was a lot of evangelical Christians from Britain who pushed for that. And I think that it's quite unfortunate that the Scofield Bible undergirds this theology, which is, I think, a mistaken missiology that says that this is very important. I think that the message of Jesus is it's no longer place, but it's person. Mm-hmm. And so our focus needs to be on the person and the community and not that place.
That's right.
So sacred places can be in a converted Buddhist temple in Shandong province.
That's right.
That's where the church, the Presbyterians started their work in Shandong province. It was an abandoned Buddhist temple. And from that came, developed eventually, the great Shandong Revival. And so that is where I put my hope, is in those communities and those places becoming sacred. But there's a huge amount of theology, missiology, money, travel, people praying in East Malaysia and Thailand around maps that focus on Jerusalem. And so I would like to see those false hopes put aside as we look around us and care for the poor and the needy and the people who are, well, the unloved, the unreached and the uncared for. The final wish that I would have is there's a book that came out, I think, last year by Andrew Scott called Scatter. And I think he's right. I think that the mission of the world is not going to be completed by, you know, funding people fully to go overseas, full-time professional missionaries. Most of the mission of the church has happened not by full-time missionaries, but by indigenous people and by migration. And so let's encourage the church, and that means Christians everywhere in the world, to look at scattering and to using their professional's vocation. Not say, okay, I used to be an engineer, I used to be an English teacher, I used to be a medical doctor, but now I'm going to give that up and I'm going to be a church planter. No, go and be a good medical doctor in northern Nigeria. Mm-hmm. Go be a good English teacher in China where they want English teachers, whatever. Use your vocation that God's given you. Be the very best you can. Mm-hmm. Rise to the top and have a Christian witness there. So I think our missiology, and a lot of people are writing about this, needs to include more migration, intentional scattering, and then encourage Christians today to say, okay, you've come to faith in Christ, and what is it you do? Okay, that's your vocation. You're an engineer. You're whatever. Where in the world could God use that skill?
That's right.
Where he needs more images of God represented?
That's right.
And so I think that's a dimension that I would like to see more of in the future.
That's excellent. Dr. Scott Sundquist, thank you for being with us on Missiology Podcast. This has been a rich conversation,
thank you.
We look forward to future conversations with you. And what's your next book coming out? You have what are some of the books right now?
Okay, White Church is coming out July 1st,
okay.
With IVP, and then I'm finishing up History of Christianity in Asia,
yes.
Volume 3. That's Sam Moffat did Volume 1 and 2. And then Dale Irvin and I are finishing up History of the World Christian Movement, Volume 3. So hopefully in the next year you'll see those.
Excellent. Well, thank you for being
with
us. All
right. God bless you.
Fantastic.